The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 367, The Mormon Image Since 1960, a paper by Jan Shipps. The chair is Nate Alder. This is a 60-minute presentation recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Site 2 will be blank.
It's my pleasure to begin this session. My name is Nate Alder, and it's an honor for me to introduce to you one of the true heroes. Can people hear me? All right. Well, I'm not an audio-visual guy, so... Are people in the back able to hear me? I've known Jan for a long time, ever since I was a child growing up in Logan, Utah. Even as a child in primary... I knew that our family had a very special place in our two-year supply of food for Jan's coffee for her frequent visits to our home. She and my dad have enjoyed a long, close relationship in Mormon history. I did not know then when I was a child that Jan was such an important figure in religious history, especially for our church. Rather, she was the mythical aunt from Indiana, who would drop by a few times each year with big hugs and laughter. And she would play baseball with us in the backyard and read bedtime stories to us, play ragtime on the piano, and also give me music lessons on my cello. Jan will always be Aunt Jan to me, and she is the same for my children. I do remember as a child asking my dad if Jan was a Mormon, and he said that the brethren very much needed Jan to be a Methodist. And that answer satisfied me back then when I was young, and later I understood why. As I grew up, I began to appreciate Jan for her brilliance and her tremendous scholarship. However, it still wasn't until after my mission that I read her authoritative book, Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition. Already having attained a testimony of the restored gospel and having taught the gospel for 2 years in Japan, when I discovered it, even though it sat on my shelf for years as I had a signed copy that Jan had given me as a young adolescent, that book had great impact on me. It helped solidify my testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith and of the church. It should be required reading, I believe, for everyone in the church. Jan has also a number of other books, some that are forthcoming. She has authored numerous articles. She's always publishing, and she's always being quoted by various media sources. Knowing Jan personally and being able to talk to her about her work and the issues both in the church and issues in general... has been a wonderful strength to me as a person and also as a member of the church. I also want to tell you that Jan is a wonderful Sunday school teacher. During my 4 years as a graduate student in Bloomington, Indiana, I had the frequent opportunity to attend her Sunday school class. Each Sunday, she directs an outstanding, very stimulating and interesting discussion at her church on issues from the scripture. There's no manual, there's no correlation, nothing from Salt Lake necessarily. Jan and her classmates just decide on what they're going to talk about the next week, and they self-direct themselves, and it is a fantastic group of people and a great discussion. And if you're ever in Bloomington on a Sunday, go down to the old downtown church and sit in on one of Jan's Sunday school classes. That is Jan Shipps in her element, an element that many of us don't know. Jan's accomplishments and honors are impressive. I could go on and on about her tremendous abilities and contributions, but I think we all know of her importance, how important she is to our faith and our understanding, and also to us as friends and as a community. Please welcome Jan Shipps.
How would I How would I know about Mormonism without friends like Nate and his wife and children, mother and father, and so forth? Somebody said, are you going to talk or are you going to read a paper? And I said, I'm going to read a paper. Hope that's okay. And you're also spread out. There's a great value of being in this room because it's cool rather than those small rooms over in the other building. But you're sort of, you know, if you're not around here, I might not make much eye contact with you. But I will read, and then I will be willing to answer questions. The topic of my paper is the Mormon image since 1960. And I need to tell you how this came about. In 1972 and 3, I did a very elaborate study of periodical literature written about the Mormons across a 100-year span. Not only did I get everything that was listed in Poole's Index and the Reader's Guide that had been indexed under Mormonism, Utah, or polygamy, and pulled that all together into a chronological list and drew a sample, but then I took that and did a content analysis, and having just been, my husband says I talk in parentheses, so I'll give you a little parentheses. When we moved to Bloomington in 1967, I had my PhD, but I didn't have a job, and I needed to go to work so that we could send our son to school. And so I went over to the university and said, is there any place that I could work and you know, add to our income? And they looked at my credentials and they looked at the jobs and they said, well, the best thing we can suggest is that you go over and apply for this job at the Kinsey Institute for Sex Research. And so I went over and I applied and got the job at the Institute for Sex Research. And in the next 2 years, I'll tell you, I learned a lot. Not exactly about sex so much as about sociology, about which I knew nothing. And the project that I was assigned to, to be the project coordinator, was a survey of, a random sample survey of American attitudes towards sex. And in doing that, I learned a little bit about how to do survey research, and that's what I did. Only all my people that I was surveying were dead, and they had to, and so I had to look at what they wrote and what they read. And this is, and I'm finally getting around to publishing that in a book that's going to be coming out, I hope, next year. And I thought I would just add a little coda to that story. And when I started adding a coda to what happened to the Mormon image since from between 1860 and 1960, the coda kept growing and growing and growing. And when I told Elbert I was coming to Sunstone, he said, you want to read a paper? And I said, well, I can take what's in the computer and bring it here, and that's what I've got. And it's turned into a separate article. Okay. In 1952, a Reader's Digest clone published an article written by Andrew Hamilton. It was called Those Amazing Mormons, and some of you yesterday heard a very fine paper called Those Amazing Mormons about minority discourse in the coverage in the media. I have a footnote in this, and I'm the only one in this hour, I will refer to some of my footnotes. I have a footnote here. I was going through Sterling McMurrin's materials, all of his correspondence and his diaries and everything else that's up at the University of Utah, and I was going through the year 1951, and I found this big section of materials that were labeled Those Amazing Mormons. And this was an article that was sent to Sterling by the editors of Carnet magazine. And Sterling said, it's terrible, don't publish it. But they did. And he started arguing with the not only with the editors, but with the author of this. It's a very interesting set of correspondence. And why he explained about it. Well, here's what it was. It reviewed LDS history. It cast the early saints as long-suffering heroes and heroines and described their descendants as hard-working people with all the Boy Scout virtues. In addition, they neither drank alcohol nor anything containing caffeine. Sterling said all of us. did not smoke and consistently refused government assistance since they took care of their own. It was published and reprinted for wide distribution by the LDS Church. This article is representative of a positive trend which, starting in the 1930s, would undercut the negative image. And I've brought one overhead to let you see. This is from my earlier study. The line in the middle is I analyzed all of these articles and had a numerical it had a numerical score that went from -30 to +30, a 60-point score. As you will see, it did not pass the neutral point, and that's from 1860 to 1960, until 1935 or 6, and then it just starts going up. Those different colors are for the actual number that I analyzed the article. The number that I used because I counted for circulation. If it was published in Look magazine or the Reader's Digest, it got more than if it was published in an obscure journal. And then the other is just a statistical thing. Yes. No, all that is that, see, that the dip is where it's weighted for circulation. It's weighted for circulation. And, oh, that dip. Oh, in 1940. I mean, that dip was because of the Colorado City, you know, back within the Short Creek. That, and it just got in the news very much. But anyway, that gives you the background. Reprinted, as I said, it reprinted a positive trend which, starting in the 1930s, would undercut the negative image that had been central to coverage of the saints in the national press during Mormonism's first 100 years. Marred only by a smattering of references to the continuing practice of plural marriage in Short Creek, Arizona. People want to know all the time why I think it's interesting to study the Mormons. Well, we lived for 9 months in Logan. And when I went to the library in Logan, Utah, and I was looking around in the library, and I was going through the fiction, and there I saw a book called The True Story of Short Creek, Arizona. And I thought, I got to study these people that put true stories in the fiction. And anyway, I got to get on with this paper. We'll never get done. Marred only by a scattering of references to the continuing practice of plural marriage in Short Creek, which many readers, non-Mormon readers, continued to connect with mainstream Mormonism. Throughout the decade of the 1950s, press coverage of the Latter-day Saints remained positive, even laudatory. By that time, however, the Mormon image was no longer being shaped primarily by the print media. Between 1847 and 1947, the great majority of Latter-day Saints had lived behind a mountain curtain in the Intermountain West and along the Pacific, especially in Southern California. During that century, the great majority of non-Mormon Americans had gained most of their information that they had about Mormonism by reading about them, or by hearsay, hearing about them from someone who had read about them. That's a lot of ministers that had read about the Mormons and then started preaching about them. Or, more rarely, from someone who had once traveled through the West, seen Zion, and met a few saints. Just as the end of World War II brought change to many areas of American life, however, So the end of that conflict also brought about a dramatic change in the opportunity citizens of the U.S. had to get to know members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It would be decades before LDS wards and stakes would be organized throughout the nation. But the end of the war accelerated the Mormon diaspora. Many saints settled far beyond the boundaries of the state of Utah, and in fact, of the American West. One consequence of this scattering of the gathering, as I called it, and as Nate's father once called it in an article, was that by the 1950s, people all across the country were starting to learn about Mormonism firsthand, meeting neighbors, people not unlike themselves, who happened to be Mormons. In addition, as soon as the wartime dearth of automobiles for sale was replaced by the availability of reasonably priced new cars, a huge increase in recreational travel carried a horde of tourists to Mormonism's center place, Utah, and most particularly Salt Lake City. Besides that, a virtual conglomeration of communications developments also occurred at mid-century. Due both to ever-cheaper versions of portable sets and the addition of radios as standard equipment in automobiles, radio became a natural adjunct to newspapers and magazines as a source of information. In addition, phonographs with either standard or hi-fi sound became all the rage at mid-century. Connected with the latter was growth in the sale of long-playing records of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, which were extremely important in those years. Perhaps above all, this middle decade of the 20th century saw commercial television rapidly take its place as a new communications medium. In the wake of these developments, the positive image of typical Mormons emanating from the periodical press was matched by the presence on the national scene of a considerable number of appealing and or impressive Mormon personalities. Among them, movie star Victor Jory, golfer Johnny Miller, swimsuit designer Rosemarie Reed, Michigan Governor George Romney, Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benton, Benson, and later Donnie Marie and the rest of the Osmond family. Viewing the panorama of presentations of the Mormon image decade by decade from 1860 to 1960, as I had done, made me very sensitive to the fact that the decade of the 1950s was one of transition from print medium to a combination of print and electronic media. And I was beginning to worry that I was going too far with just analyzing and basing an analysis of the Mormon image on print media. This shift added attractive oral and visual images to less illuminating and arguably more easily manipulated print portraits of the saints. The church's public affairs division was able to take marvelous advantage of the many new venues for telling the Mormon story, projecting a flattering image of the Mormons in the process. But these same communications advances made it impossible for me to do a post-1960 study of perceptions of the saints, based as my earlier period had been on the print media. Nevertheless, having done that earlier study made me so acutely conscious of media presentation of the saints, whether print or electronic, that I am able to advance an argument that if you take the electronic media into account, the years between, say, 1963-4 and 1975-6 form an almost unique period in the history of perceptions of the saints, what you might call a golden age. And I know I am departing here a bit from what Dennis Lisko did, but he was working with print media, and appearance of some negative articles, especially about the blacks in the print media, is overwhelmed, I'm convinced, though I have not done it systematically, that with the pictures that were coming on to TV and radio, which never mentioned the issue of the blacks. The LDS Church had what Americans who embraced the civil rights movement regarded as a retrograde position on race. And that fact did not fail to be to gain to generate comment, especially in the elite Eastern press. But that encumbrance was usually overlooked when, almost as a reminder that the entire nation had not gone the way of the much maligned, pot-smoking, flag-burning counterculture, both the print and electronic media started featuring all sorts of images of Mormons as neat, modest, virtuous, and patriotic people. This contrast made the image of the saints even more appealing than it had been in the 50s, making this a time when at least Middle America's perceptions of the saints would be overwhelmingly positive. In fact, I am convinced that it was the dramatic discrepancy between clean-cut Mormons and scruffy hippies that completed the transformation of the Mormon image from the quasi-foreign, somewhat alien likeness that it had had in the 19th century to the more than 100% super-American portrait of the late 60s and early 70s. This led to a situation in which it became not at all uncommon to hear people who studied American culture speak about the Mormons being, quote, more American than the Americans. And I must have heard that very much in papers that were given in professional meetings in the American Studies Association meeting and meetings of the religious studies, various religious studies meetings. The LDS Church still had to maintain its distance from a growing body of so-called new polygamists by making sure that they were not confused with real Mormons. And it is possible that the need to make this distinction could have played a role in the nomenclature adjustment that led to implementation of a long-standing position regarding the way the members of the church ought to describe themselves and be described by others. It was Klaus Hansen that pointed out to me that in the 1960s that people, Mormons, were being asked not to call themselves Mormons but Latter-day Saints. It was not just yesterday. It was not just the 90s, but it was early on. He said that nobody paid any attention to them, so they stopped talking about it. They have paid attention to them now. Where once, following the first prophet, they had embraced and perhaps gloried in being called Mormons, now church members were encouraged to refer to themselves as Latter-day Saints because those people who practice polygamy call themselves Mormons. The church also, at this time, needed to downplay the importance of a vocal and somewhat truculent group of former saints by ignoring their efforts to scour the historical record and publish information that helped them justify their turn away from Mormonism. Now, that is a reference to Gerald and Sandra Tanner and other ex-Mormons. Yet the 1978 revelation permitting all worthy men to hold the priesthood appeared to have put the troublesome race issue behind the LDS Church, at least for a couple of decades. And, on another front, despite the press brouhaha around the excommunication of Sonny Johnson and the IYW debacle, the Mormon emphasis on family values seems to have trumped the church's anti-ERA stance in the eyes of a majority of those who thought much about this issue. As a consequence, those troublesome matters, they would now be called political correctness issues, were apparently doing little in this golden age to besmirch the positive Mormon image. Now, every historian who is acquainted with the historical sources will become aware of a fairly persuasive expectation within the LDS community that church members had to be prepared to undergo persecution for their faith. But by the time of the church's sesquicentennial in 1980, the internal excitement of exponential church growth was creating such a general atmosphere of hope and optimism that it looked like Latter-day Saints had little reason to anticipate much change in the salutary climate of opinion surrounding them. Therefore, many saints were both shocked and appalled at the appearance in the late 70s and 1980s of a negative subtext to many of the media presentations of Mormons and Mormonism. Sometimes, and I must say that I do agree that in this golden age, the Mormons were a minority, a kind of minority, as we heard yesterday in that paper. But sometimes, despite everything members of the public communication staff could do to head it off, negativism became more than subtext. Perpetually benign pictures of the church and positive descriptions of Mormons as saints, almost too perfect to believe, were challenged by several critical 60-minute segments and a number of other things that went onto the TV in early versions of TV magazine journalism. In addition, a number of articles about the new polygamy were published in documentaries that failed to make much distinction between the LDS Church and its schismatic offshoots were aired on network TV. The Godmakers, a videotape ridiculing Mormon doctrine, was promoted by conservative Protestants who featured it in special services in many of their churches. And a number of handsome books designed to reveal Mormonism's underside were issued by reputable and well-known presses. Now, one of the traditional ways of disseminating the Mormon image was, and still is, with music and the spoken word. The weekly Sunday morning television broadcast from the historic tabernacle, which stands in Temple Square at the foot of the Eternal Hills in Salt Lake City. Typically, along with a well-known Mormon hymn and a classical selection, the Tabernacle Choir broadcast include performances of some of the American people's best-loved inspirational music, some of it religious and some not. The spoken word is likewise inspirational, but generically so, with distinctive LDS doctrinal tenets either blunted or altogether missing. The effect is heartwarming, producing admiration for the performers and the people they epitomize. But however much this lovely program elevates the spirit or motivates the observer, it reveals little or nothing about the idiosyncratic LDS doctrines that separate Mormonism from the historic forms of Christianity, Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox. Starting out as a radio broadcast, one of the quite obvious aims of this program was and is the presentation of an acceptable image of Mormonism. But like the images of practically everything else from the mid-century forward, by 1980 the Mormon image was not simply transmitted through Tabernacle Choir performances and publication of engaging articles in the periodical press. It was being carefully shaped by a skilled public relations team from whose offices issued a steady stream of press releases telling the world about the LDS Church and its members. They still didn't talk much about distinctive Mormon doctrines, but by 1980, many of these described instances that demonstrated Mormons' willingness to cooperate with members of other faith communities in delivering assistance in the face of natural disaster and helping in times of demonstrated human need, and this was accelerated in the 1990s. They indicated thereby that the saints were open to going beyond taking care of their own. These accounts diminished the distance between Latter-day Saints and other religious groups. But countless other press releases concentrated on LDS success by dealing in one way or another with church growth, the organization of new church units, branches, wards, and stakes, all across the nation and in many parts of the world, the building of new temples, and the passing of million markers in numbers of members. At the same time, Mormonism itself was becoming ever more visible. The Mormon Church had been practically invisible outside the West as long as LDS missions in the various regions of the United States had been housed in large, sometimes historic mansions purchased for the purpose. In the mid-20th century, however, it emerged as a part of the religious landscape as LDS stakehouses and ward chapels, most of them looking almost exactly alike, were built in cities and towns all across the nation. I've written an article about that for the Mormon, historical atlas of Mormonism. To the surprise of many and the dismay of some, it suddenly seemed that the Mormons were everywhere. And people have said that to me so many times. More disturbed about these developments than anyone else were members of the new and or recently revitalized conservative Protestant, that means evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal bodies, a part of Christianity that was likewise growing exponentially. Leaders of these groups had long considered Mormonism to be one of four indigenous American cults, and when it started to outstrip the others in both visibility and numbers of converts, Mormonism started to appear much more dangerous than the Christian Scientists, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Seventh-day Adventists, that is, the other cults. In reality, what had been happening in the post-World War II era is that Mormons and evangelicals were regarding the nation as a field ripe to the harvest. They were both regarding the nation that way. The problem was that LDS and evangelical workers were laboring in the same parts of the field, a competitive situation that seems to have caused conservative Protestants to regard the success of Latter-day Saints as illegitimate. One result of this for religious commitments was that a good market developed for anti-Mormon materials. It's always been there, but it just skyrocketed. The most spectacular of these materials turned out to be The Godmakers, The Mormon Quest for Godhood, a book written by Ed Decker and Dave Hunt with the assistance of Gerald and Sandra Tanner and other ex-Mormons. This work became the basis of a 56-minute attack film, also available as a video, which transformed Mormon theology into a science fiction scenario and accused the Mormons of not being Christian. The stated purpose of both the book and the film was, and this is a quote, unmasking the myth of Mormonism by revealing everything about the Latter-day Saints from family home evening through the secret temple rituals. The book and the film were distributed by Utah Missions Incorporated, publishers of the Utah Evangel, now simply the Evangel, a newsprint periodical devoted to exposing Mormonism, that's on the masthead, which had been started in 1954 by a Baptist minister who had served 17 years in Utah. We heard from the current minister of the largest Southern Baptist church in Salt Lake City now that the Southern Baptists have separated themselves from and are no longer distributing this film. But they distributed it in these years, and they would show it in these evangelical meetings and pass around buckets, cardboard buckets, the way they do at a Billy Graham meeting, and ask for contributions to fight the Mormons. It was an astonishing agenda. The Godmakers was the most visible of a whole genre of anti-Mormon literature that assailed Mormonism from the religious standpoint, and I'm going to be making a distinction between religious and secular. Whether in broadsides, pamphlets, articles, books, or films, the genre's central message was and still is that Mormonism is not Christian. It is rather a heretical movement. In the days before the full-scale political and cultural mobilization of the religious right, this charge resonated more soundly with members of certain conservative Protestant groups than with the American public generally. And that's something that it has now escaped it in some ways, and that's a problem. This reality became manifest when the Reverend Jerry Falwell organized the Moral Majority, a political movement in which he sought to unite members of the LDS Church with members of fundamental and evangelical churches all over the country in order to exert pressure on the Republican Party. After all, they had the same social agenda. The famed pastor of the Thomas Road Independent Baptist Megachurch in Lynchburg, Virginia, was astonished to discover that even to achieve their desired political goals, fundamentalist, evangelical, and Pentecostal Christians were unwilling to be yoked with the Latter-day Saints. And therefore, eventually, particularly for this reason, there were a few other reasons, but this was one of the major reasons the moral majority was disbanded. Now, Falwell has now come back into prominence, but for a while, he lost a lot of his following. Throughout the 1980s, other religious indictments formed much of the negative subtext that cast a shadow on the essentially positive Mormon image. The books about the new polygamy, both quite obviously more subtext than text, appeared in 1981. Simon & Schuster's Linden Press issued Thy Kingdom Come, a novel with a plotline that included polygamy still being practiced at the highest levels of the LDS Church hierarchy. In fact, a member in that novel, a member of the First Presidency, is a polygamist. Since Peter Bart, the author of this trade book, had been in Salt Lake City doing research as the book was being written, this work was reputed to be a romanoclef in which real people and real events were represented under the guise of fiction. That same year, G.P. Putnam's Sons, another New York trade press, published Prophet of Blood, the untold story of Irva LeBaron and the Lambs of God by Washington investigative journalist Ben Bradley and Dale Van Atta. While it dealt with a schismatic form of Mormonism, in the minds of readers unfamiliar with Mormonism, it inevitably connected the saints to the renewed practice of plural marriage as well as to murder. Now one wonders what's going on with the renewal of this business about polygamy today. These, however, were only the precursors of a series of books that are best characterized as neo-19th century expose, a kind of expose that dealt almost entirely with the secular side of Mormonism. The Mormon corporate empire clearly fits into this category, and it's the most important of these books. Written by John Heinemann, a disillusioned Latter-day Saint, and Anson Shoup, a sociologist of good reputation who was best known for his earlier work on the Unification Church, this work in 1985. With information gained from the public record and investigative reporting that some people regard as unethical snooping, since it sometimes involved misrepresentation on Heinemann's part, this work uses chapter and verse evidence to make the argument that the LDS Church is first and foremost a money-generating machine whose leaders are more concerned with adding to the fabulous wealth of the LDS Church than anything else. Now, 6 years later, Shoup would publish The Darker Side of Virtue, Corruption, Scandal, and the Mormon Empire. Its dust jacket reads, "Behind the ideal image promoted by the LDS Church, a darker side of Mormonism exists. The same Mormon ethos that has instilled many positive characteristics in its people has also led to dramatic instances of corruption, scandal, abuse of power, and even murder." But long before Shoup's second work on Mormonism was published, the Hoffman Saga, a terrible Mormon tragedy, precipitated what I have been calling subtext into the headlines in both the print and electronic media. Moreover, it catapulted the LDS Church specifically and Mormonism generally into public view in such a way that what could be called classic accusations about religious illegitimacy and secular mendacity were combined. While this is not the place to review this well-known story, it is the place to point to the way Mark Hoffman's plagiarism and his subsequent murders of Stephen Christensen and Kathy Sheets led to a convergence of the religious and secular in the multitudinous accounts of this gripping story. First and foremost, certainly in the early news accounts, what had occurred was described as a secular story of murder and greed in which the protagonist simply happened to be a Mormon. But when news organizations sent their crime reporters rather than their religion reporters to Salt Lake City to cover the story, those reporters soon realized that there was so much religion mixed up in the story that it could not be adequately covered without considerable familiarity with the LDS system of belief, Mormon history, and those who wrote it. Peggy Stack, Nee Fletcher, first put into words for me the dilemma the Hoffman story presented to a newspaper editor and its supervisory staff and all news organizations. Many of them soon realized that their crime reporters didn't know enough about Mormonism to cover the story properly. But they were afraid that their religion reporters could not cover the story satisfactorily because they didn't know enough about crime and the legal maneuvering that immediately started to take place after Hoffman was charged with murder. Now, I personally quickly learned that Peggy was right. Probably because the University of Illinois Press had just issued my Mormonism book about 6 months before the story broke, and because reviews published in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, and so forth, made much of my not being a Mormon. Only one day after Hoffman's arrest, I started getting requests from reporters for phone interviews. I was not used to this. The telephone conversations that followed revealed an abysmal lack of knowledge of Mormonism on the part of many of those assigned to the story. For almost 2 weeks, I fielded enough phone calls from people writing for papers and magazines all over the United States, and, in fact, TV and radio, all over the United States, to convince several IUPUI secretaries that I must really be somebody. I think Paul Edwards also had this experience of the New York Times calling or Time Magazine calling and so forth. The secretaries really get blown away, don't they, Paul? While most of the reporters who called had been in Salt Lake City long enough to have learned the identity of the first Mormon prophet, the great majority did not, quote, speak Mormon, and they needed a translator. Furthermore, most knew so little about the murderer's cultural and religious background and the religious significance of some of the forged items he had produced that I found myself endlessly repeating what amounted to the introductory lecture on the Latter-day Saints that I usually gave to students in Introduction to Religion courses. Now, the Hoffman story remained in the news long enough for most of the religion reporters to get a crack at it. In addition, it became the basis for 5 full-length books, the first of which was the exemplary Salamander, the story of the Mormon forgery murders, written by Linda Sillitoe and Alan Roberts, whom we heard yesterday, both Latter-day Saints. This work presented the best balance of the secular and religious dimensions of this awful episode in the recent Mormon past. As might be expected of a book written by the managing director of the LDS Church Historical Division, Victims, the LDS Church, in the Mark Hoffman case, and this is the book that appeared last, gives more weight to the story's religious than its legal aspects. The author, Richard E. Turley, was trained as a lawyer, and his account of the legal maneuverings of the story is clear and precise, but the main purpose of the work was getting the part of the story played by the church into the record. He had access to the journals of the church leaders who were involved. On the other hand, Robert Lindsay's A Gathering of Saints, a true story of money, murder, and deceit, is weighted in the other direction, that is, away from religion. Lindsay, for 20 years, a reporter and correspondent for the New York Times, briefly reviews the Saints' trek from Iowa and their arrival in the Great Salt Lake Valley, and alludes briefly to Mormon history where necessary for clarity. But his account, which was published in the New York by Trade Press, has a secular cast. The book by Gerald and Sandra Tanner, on the other hand, inevitably tells the story from the religious perspective. But that's a much better book, and all of them are, than the Mormon murders, in hardcover and paper. Featured in bookstores all across the nation, and I've just reread it, it's unbelievable, including airport bookstores where it became a popular choice for travel reading. The Mormon murders not only told the story of Mark Hoffman, but also, according to the review in the New York Times, contained a, quote, rich trove of details about the deceit, lying, and covering up by top LDS church leaders. If the authors claim, prominently displayed on the back of the book, that Hoffman's forged documents rocked the very foundation and legitimacy of the Mormon Church and its multi-million-dollar empire was mistaken, and it certainly was, the tales of intrigue regarding the church's dealings with Hoffman as he produced one rare document after another, some of them threatening to discredit elements of the canonized story of the Mormon past, delivered a severe, though glancing, blow to the Mormon image. Yet the blow was fierce enough to spur damage control in the form of a rare press conference in which Gordon B. Hinckley, Dallin Oaks, and Hugh Pinnock, members of the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve, who had met with or had dealings with Hoffman, made statements and answered the questions of dozens of reporters representing both local and national print and electronic media. Secondly, on July 6, 1987, after Hoffman had confessed and been imprisoned, a one-day church-sponsored public conference organized by the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute of Church History was held at BYU. Its purpose was clearing the air and getting the story on the record, including the part played by Dean Jesse, a scholar in the employ of the church, and other Mormon historians in clearing up the mystery of the forged documents. Richard Bushman and I were asked to attend the conference, listen to the proceedings, and at the end of the day, present our assessments of the damage Hoffman might have done to Mormon history. And I have a long footnote here, which talks about how ironic that was, since it was Richard Bushman and I who, in a Sunstone symposium the year before, had made the first public discussions of the Salamander letter. The final speaker at the conference, Elder Dallin Oaks, took this opportunity to speak for the record on a number of issues that have been of immense interest to scholars. And this is a quote now. He said he wanted to speak for the record on a number of issues that have been of an immense interest to scholars, church members, and the general public. His was an important talk because it presented the church's official answer to charges about alleged suppression of documents. Its official explanation of how often and for what reasons Mark Hoffman gained interviews with Gordon B. Hinckley, a member of the First Presidency, and other church officials, and its official clarification of which documents the church obtained through gift as opposed to purchases arranged by the church historical department personnel. And I heard Alan Roberts yesterday say that it didn't tell the whole story, and maybe it didn't, but nevertheless. The speech also provided factual clarification about the church's role in the aborted efforts to facilitate purchase of the Salamander letter and the McClellan documents so that they could be given to the church. In addition, Oaks lamented the fact that during the whole Hoffman episode, members of the church saw some of the most intense LDS church bashing since the turn of the century. Although members of the press in Utah were enraged about this, Oaks was absolutely right with regard to the national press. Having recently reviewed the media's coverage of this story, I must say that while certain reporters clearly made an effort to convey the necessary information without prejudice, the national as opposed to local coverage of the story contain an astonishing amount of innuendo associating Hoffman's plagiarism with Mormon beginnings. Reports of allegations of secrecy and cover-up on the part of LDS general authorities, and even references to the way in which a culture that rested on a found scripture was bound to be subject to the offerings of con artists. Remember all the stories about Mormons and the land of the scam and so forth. Having filed five full-length books, two of them trade books, devoted to it, gave the Hoffman story a surprisingly long media life. Though we've never had the story on I understand they're about to do an A&E story. Now, we don't know. But after a while, normality reasserted itself. The church continued to grow by leaps and bounds. New temples were announced. and built. Latter-day Saints continue to render assistance to people suffering from the effects of natural disaster. Attractive Mormons made heartening news in the political arena and in sports and entertainment. Family values were in the ascendancy on the national agenda, and a positive shine once again appeared on the Mormon image. Even with the Nathan Smith allegations of dissimulation on the part of early Mormon leaders embedded in the Mormon murders that was still making the rounds, the Mormon image was sufficiently positive, not enough, not to be besmirched by the attacks on it made in 1991 in books written by Anson Shoup and James Coates. Besides investment scams, accusations of child sexual abuse against pillars of the Mormon community, and other horrors, Shoup's second book about Mormonism includes a strange and extraordinarily strained argument accusing the Mormon Church of complicity in the shuttle disaster. And I've got a full-page footnote on that. Coates, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, wrote in Mormon Circles, Gentiles, Jack Mormons, and Latter-day Saints, a work filled with superficial caricature, information that is just inaccurate, incorrect, and plain wrong. The book also contains lots of material about what the author calls the core LDS mysteries, mainly provided by the Utah Lighthouse Ministry publications, that is the story of Gerald and Sandra Tanner, as well as the new Utah Lighthouse Ministries, that's the Southern Baptist minister, and Gerald and Sandra Tanner, as well as about the new polygamy information provided to him by members of those groups. Both exposés include chapters on the Hoffman episode, but neither adds new material to add to what was already known. What these two and similar books and articles purport to do is either to reveal hidden truths about Mormonism or take the lid off a great LDS conspiracy that needs to see the light of day. Despite Time magazine's cover story on the Saints that called the world's attention to Mormons Incorporated last year, as measured by subsequent references to such works in national print and electronic coverage of the Saints, the agenda for the media treatment of Mormonism in the 1990s was not set by expose-like works with a secular bent. Perhaps Mark Silk, the former columnist for the Atlanta Constitution and now director of the Center for Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, is right. He argues in a recent book, The Unsecular Media, that the media is not a secular wasteland where the main attention paid to a religion is on the way it impinges on the secular side of life. Certainly, the principal coverage of Mormonism in the 1990s would suggest that Silk is on to something. A review of what in Mormonism has been newsworthy in the 1990s suggests that the world's attention is being directed to Mormonism's religious dimensions. Even without checking through every reference to Latter-day Saints that has made its way into LexisNexis, that marvelous index of what the media is doing these days, I would suggest that the news has been dominated by stories that are connected to Mormonism as a religion. Just think about the recent events, occurrences, and happenings that have made their way out of the valley and into the national media. Except for the coming of the Olympics to Utah, the big 1990s news stories have almost all been about religion, and so you can see that the modern Mormon image is being shaped by such stories as stories about LDS missionary work, and these go into television and radio, as well as into the print media. The church's activity in locating sites for and building and dedicating temples, huge amounts of print and television and radio space is devoted when a new temple is coming to an area. Billings, Montana, for example. They didn't like where they wanted to put the temple. And lots of places don't like where they want to put a temple. I just know about that particularly because I have a good friend. Our son's godparents live in Billings, and his godmother called me and she said, "They're going to build a Mormon temple in Billings. Shall I send you the newspaper?" And I said, "Sure, I'd like to see it." And when the newspaper came, it had a big quote from me. So it was sort of funny. So I know about that one. So she kept sending me the stuff. But these stories are very much all through the nation. The church changing of the wording in the temple rituals made a big splash. Events at BYU also made a big splash. The 1983 October purge made a splash. And the change in the church's logo generated a number of articles and also television shows. The baptizing of Holocaust victims by young Mormons. And of course, the reenactment of the trek. I believe that a review of the coverage of these stories will at least be an indicator of the modern LDS image, but only when it is set against that super shaper of images in our nation, that is the 60 Minutes message. Some of you may recall my analysis, printed in Sunstone, of what Mike Wallace missed. What is significant here is what he did not miss. Standing back and recalling that story from the perspective of a couple of years, it is even more obvious now that this veteran newsman accepted LDS Church President Gordon B. Hinckley's message, which can be summed up in a compound declarative sentence. The Mormons are not weird, and Latter-day Saints are a truly religious people. Mike Wallace's only caveat was, yes, but they live in a land of funny underwear. Although the LDS Church was surely gratified by and with the show as it aired on an Easter Sunday evening, and it should have been gratified by it, recalling the program and reading the transcript with analytic glasses reveals that the message was essentially a return to the Mormon image of the Golden Age, which can be summed up as Latter-day Saints are ordinary people with sincere beliefs. What they believe is not so important as whether they sincerely believe it. And not only do they sincerely believe it, but they put it into practice. Now that is the 1960-70 message, and is exactly what we were hearing yesterday about the minority that's set aside. We say good things about the minority. They don't inquire about what Mormonism believes or what it involves so much as that everybody is sincere. In that earlier period, two things were very different, however. For one, the nation's attention was focused on Vietnam, and religious belief and practice seemed less important than one's patriotism or lack of same at that time. The second thing that was different is that back then, the Mormons were still a religious minority. Americans, but quaint. Something like the Mennonites or the Moravians, or perhaps like the Jews, since they took care of their own, or like Asian Americans, as we heard yesterday. Very interesting, the parallels. But the saints at that time were still other, not quite us. And I always print that, and every time somebody reads it, they point out that I've made a typo. I don't. I print it with capital letters. Not quite U.S., United States. Not quite United States. Or not quite us. It was still them and us. The nature of their belief system was not so much at issue. What was important was the obvious reality that they were insincere about it. They believed it and put it into practice. Nowadays, the Latter-day Saints, and if there's anything to come in this paper, it comes right here. Nowadays, the Latter-day Saints are not a religious minority. Their church is the fifth largest church in the nation. And members of the LDS Church are losing the protection of minority religious status. That's very important. This is no small matter, because it means that what goes on within the LDS community is no longer protected from the inquiring minds of the general public, so much so that if anybody inquires what it is that the Latter-day Saints do, it's not enough to say it's none of your business, but you're a part of the larger culture. What Latter-day Saints believe and what they and their leaders do becomes grist for the media mill. Matters of real interest to the public as that interest is expressed by the media. The significant stories in the 1990s, as I talked about them, show this clearly. Look at the ones already mentioned. Missionary work, the church's activity in building temples and so forth, the church is changing the word in the temple rituals, events at BYU, the 1983 purge, the change in the LDS church logo, the baptizing of Holocaust victims, the reenactment of the trek, and add to that the stories that got on the wire about Mike Quinn's book, the same-sex dynamics, and Todd Compton's book about Joseph Smith and polygamy. This is all grist for the mill. And you are now not protected as a religious minority, because there are more, you're more viewed than there are Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Episcopalians and the people that have been at the core of America's religious life. They're not more viewed than the Baptists or the Methodists or the Catholics or the Lutherans, but everybody else, there's more of you than them. So you're no longer a religious minority. And that is terribly important. If it is not just their sincerity, but the real, rather than a caricatured version of Mormon belief that becomes subject to media coverage, the Mormons will inevitably gain new and important dimensions. No longer, and I'm on the last page, no longer will Latter-day Saints be the stick figures capable of being captured in cartoons of the 19th century and the two-dimensional characters of the second half of the 20th century. But the saints will have to pay the cost, just as the members of the Roman Catholic community have to live with the church's politically incorrect position on women's access to the priesthood, the anti-intellectualism of the Roman Curia, and what the church did to Hans Kuhn and Charles Curran. So whether they are called Mormons, Latter-day Saints, or Mormon Christians, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will have to defend themselves or glory in being a part of a church in which women have no access to the priesthood. A good proportion of the church leadership adopts an anti-intellectual stance. Note, I didn't say they were intellectuals, but they adopt that stance. And the fact that some BYU professors fail to get tenure for religious reasons. While President Hinckley may remind the media that more than 99% of his sheep, 99.9% I think he said, are safe in the fold and what happens to the others doesn't really matter, as the leader of a group with no minority status, he has to realize that what happened to Levina Feely Anderson, Mike Quinn, et al. Is really significant and not just to members of the faith. What goes on within Mormonism is no longer simply an internal issue. And this means that reporters can be expected to point to differences between what the saints believe and do as a part of media coverage of the Mormon story. Last year, the Public Communications Office was not at all pleased with either the ABC coverage or the PBS coverage of the reenactment of the trek, because the ABC coverage looked to the notion that Mormons understand themselves to grow into gods. And they talked to President Hinckley, and he said it wasn't important, and then they talked to a couple in Dallas who just gave the story of Mormon doctrine. Very interesting. And they hated the PBS thing even worse, because its story, and they spent a lot of time helping them with the story and everything, and they brought the PR person from Washington out here, or from New York out here, and so forth. They flew me out for this thing, too. The NPR flew me out, not the church. And then when it came out, there was more in that story about Gail Houston and praying to the Heavenly Mother than there was about Mormonism generally. Now, as a member, if you lose your minority status, it's hard to say, no, you can't do this. And so, in the long run, I believe that this change will benefit the LDS Church and its members because it will make them multidimensional. But as the change is happening, the Mormon image is less than fixed. In the new millennium, we will have to wait and see what the Olympics bring, what that media blitz will do, and what the 20th century image will be. I suspect, however, that it will be shaped as much what goes on the Internet as much as in the print and electronic media. Now, in this paper, I've tried to show you how I've made the shift, or I hope I have, between the print medium and the electronic media. But I'll tell you, I'm getting old. I'm going to leave the tracking of the Mormon image in the new media environment to scholars younger than me. I'm sorry I didn't have time for questions, but I had a lot there to say, and said it. Yeah.